KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Is momentous both in this individual case and issue involving birthright citizenship, but for all of the lawsuits challenging executive branch policies.
The Supreme Court gives a major win to the Trump administration, limiting the power of judges to check a president.
For Friday, June 27th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, why the murder rate is falling dramatically in many U.S. cities.
We've shown collectively that what we're doing is impactful, effective, and it's saving lives.
Also, could a brutal war be ending between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo?
Plus, hitmaker Steve Aoki explains how he pulls lots of genres into electronic dance music, from country to hip-hop.
At the end of the day, like electronic music, EDM, is like the instrumental of a vocalist.
Also remembering Lalo Schifrin, the man behind the Mission Impossible theme.
Feel free to sing along after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump says the U.S. is cutting off tariff talks with Canada as that country proceeds with a digital services tax that would affect tech giants headquartered in the U.S. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben reports on the latest amid a flurry of trade news from the president.
Trump wrote on social media this afternoon that the U.S. is, quote, hereby terminating all discussions on trade with Canada effective immediately over Canada's digital services tax that takes effect on June 30th. That tax will be on revenues the companies generate from Canadian users. Trump added that the U.S. will inform Canada of the new tariff rate Americans will pay for Canadian goods within the next week. Trump also said today that he might move a July 9th deadline when tariffs on many countries are set to increase sharply. He had said he would negotiate tariff deals with other countries by then. Only one such deal has been struck, with the UK. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, the White House.
The Supreme Court has upheld the part of the Affordable Care Act that made preventative care, like cancer screenings, free for patients. As NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin explains, it's the latest case of justices preserving former President Obama's signature health care law.
The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is made up of volunteer experts. If they determine that a cancer screening or preventive medication is based on good evidence, the Affordable Care Act requires health insurers to cover it without any cost to patients. Braidwood Management, a company owned by Christian conservatives in Texas, challenged the constitutionality of the task force. It objected to covering HIV prevention medications. But the justices upheld the status quo in a 6-3 decision. The majority opinion, written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, noted that the health secretary, currently Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has the power to review the recommendations. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
California Governor Gavin Newsom is suing Fox News and one of its hosts for defamation, claiming the network lied about him on behalf of President Trump. From member KQED in San Francisco, Marisa Lagos reports.
The lawsuit accuses Fox News and host Jesse Waters of lying about when a phone call between Newsom and Trump took place, and then accusing the governor of being a liar on air. The phone call came as immigration raids and protests swept Los Angeles, and the president deployed armed troops to the city over the governor's objections. In a conversation broadcast on his Substack, Newsom said he wants an apology.
You can't maliciously slander someone. You can't defame someone by altering facts, editing facts knowingly.
In a statement, a spokesperson for Fox News called the suit a transparent publicity stunt and vowed to fight it. For NPR News, I'm Marisa Lagos in San Francisco.
Another milestone for the financial markets today, with the S&P and the NASDAQ both hitting record highs. The NASDAQ rose 105 points today. You're listening to NPR. The world's poorest countries appear to be falling increasingly far behind. That's based on an assessment from the World Bank, which says it's completed the first comprehensive look at 39 countries with, quote, fragile and conflict-affected situations. The report looked at countries from the Marshall Islands in the Pacific to Mozambique, finding since the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, they've seen their economic outlook per person decline by an average of 1.8% a year. That's compared to other developing countries, which on average growth in individual output of 2.9% a year. A Colorado funeral homeowner who improperly stored nearly 190 bodies has been sentenced to 20 years in prison. Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce says John Holford's sentence was for fraud involving COVID aid funds.
Holford pled guilty to using nearly $900,000 in COVID aid to fund a lavish lifestyle, including the purchase of luxury cars and vacations. This as dead bodies remained stacked in a decrepit rural building for years, and grieving families were given fake ashes. The bodies were found in 2023. Holford also faces sentencing in August in a state case involving 191 charges of corpse abuse. His wife, Carrie Holford, has hearings for both her federal and state cases in September. For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce in Colorado Springs.
Crude oil futures prices moved higher today. Oil up 28 cents a barrel to end the session at $65.52 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast. Available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington, where the Supreme Court wrapped up its term with a bang today. A few of today's decisions could affect people all over the country, and we'll hear about some of them in other parts of the program. The biggest ruling came in a case testing whether the Constitution guarantees U.S. citizenship to everyone born in the U.S. But here's the thing. While the judges dodged the question of birthright citizenship, their 6-3 decision on ideological lines dramatically limits the power of federal judges on almost any issue. The Trump administration wanted to limit universal injunctions. That's when a federal judge blocks a law or an executive order, not just for the specific plaintiffs who brought the case, but for everyone. So the big story today is not exactly about who is a citizen. It's about how far a lower court judge can go to stop a law or policy that may be unconstitutional. Amanda Frost studies immigration and citizenship law at the University of Virginia. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So the court has limited universal injunctions. How big a change is this to the role of judges in our system of government?
Yeah, I think this is momentous. It expands executive branch authority and in turn limits the role of the courts, as well as overwhelming the lower federal courts with lawsuits, because now the only way to get relief in cases challenging executive branch policies is for each and every individual to file a lawsuit, unless there's a class action available, which is not a device that's available in every case.
So to take the specific example of the birthright citizenship case, three different court injunctions had blocked that executive order. The Supreme Court reduced the scope of all three. Does that mean this can now be enforced in places where no one has challenged it in court, but the executive order cannot be enforced in places where there have been successful lawsuits? Like, how does this actually work?
The answer is likely yes. And I'll just point out every district court to address this question of the constitutionality and legality of the executive order purporting to end birthright citizenship held that it was blatantly unconstitutional, which is the language of one judge. But nonetheless, as a result of the Supreme Court ruling, if the individual involved didn't file a lawsuit and lives in a state that didn't sue, it's quite possible that their child born within 30 days of this ruling or after 30 days of this ruling would not be a citizen, or at least they'd have to demonstrate their own citizenship and immigration status before their child would be recognized as a citizen. So this ruling is momentous, both in this individual case and issue involving birthright citizenship, but in addition, for all of the lawsuits challenging executive branch policies under this president and any future president.
And so, taking the wide-angle view beyond birthright citizenship, does this mean that any president can issue an executive order that is blatantly unconstitutional, hypothetically speaking, on guns or climate or immigration or literally anything, and until the Supreme Court has a chance to weigh in on it, the executive order will remain in effect?
Yes. I mean, there's a good example. Maybe a future president would say everyone has to turn in their handguns. No one can have a gun, which would clearly violate the Second Amendment and the court's jurisprudence. And yet, unless and until the Supreme Court weighs in, that executive order could apply to everyone who didn't file a lawsuit. I will say there's one caveat to that, which is individual states have sued to challenge the birthright citizenship policy. And in the Supreme Court decision today, the court did send it back to the lower courts and said, you need to determine the scope of the injunction needed to provide relief to these individual states. And that's because it's difficult to craft relief for a state that doesn't acknowledge that it needs to apply beyond individuals born within that state. And of course, could apply to anyone who moves around this country freely, as we all have a right to do.
Even though this decision was split on ideological lines, judges across the ideological spectrum have criticized nationwide injunctions. So what reason did the majority give for limiting them so dramatically?
Yes, and I will just say that I think nationwide injunctions can be overused and aren't appropriate in every case, as many judges have said, as many academics have said as well, who studied this issue, including myself. But the way the court decided this case is to say that it's likely beyond the authority of the lower courts to do this. And that really takes off the table universal injunctions. However, injunctive relief can be provided still that's broad enough to provide complete relief to the plaintiffs, which could mean extending beyond individual plaintiffs in some cases. We'll have to see how this plays out.
You said that this could lead to hundreds or thousands of lawsuits on any given issue. Is the court system ready for that?
No. Short answer, no. And they're already overwhelmed. The system is under enormous stress as it is. And now they look to be flooded with lawsuits. You know, anyone who's expecting a child over the next year, 30 days from now or beyond, will have to demonstrate their status for their child to be recognized as a citizen, unless they are somehow included within the relief given to individual plaintiffs or states.
Amanda Frost is a professor at the University of Virginia Law School. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And after we recorded that conversation, the ACLU and other groups filed a nationwide class action lawsuit challenging the executive order on birthright citizenship on behalf of all families in the U.S. subject to the order.
Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo have signed what President Trump is calling a peace deal, and he says it also comes with mineral rights for the U.S. The war is a complicated one with many players and countries involved, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio says there is still work to do. But U.S. officials are hoping this brings about a new era for the region and new business deals. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
President Trump says he thinks he should get credit for ending a brutal war between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
You know, they were fighting for years, and it was machetes, it was vicious, it was as vicious, people's heads being chopped off.
But the war in eastern Congo is a difficult one to unwind, and President Trump himself says he's a little out of his league on this. The conflict has its roots in the Rwandan genocide and involves other countries and militias fighting over the region's mineral riches. In recent months, the Rwandan-backed M23 rebel group has taken over several towns and cities. Despite evidence from the UN and others, Rwanda denies it's helping the rebels, and its foreign minister, Olivier Nduhungirehe, says there's a lot of mistrust.
There is a great deal of uncertainty in our region and beyond because many previous agreements have not been implemented, and there is no doubt that the road ahead will not be easy.
Sitting at the same table at the State Department, his Congolese counterpart, Therese Kayikwamba Wagner, put it this way.
Peace is a choice, but also responsibility to respect international law, to uphold human rights, and to protect the sovereignty of states. Those who have suffered the most are watching.
A Congolese doctor who won a Nobel Peace Prize for his work in helping victims of sexual violence says the deal doesn't mention anything about justice for the victims. And Denise Mukwege writes on social media that no real peace can ignore the large-scale massacres suffered by civilians in eastern Congo. Secretary of State Marco Rubio acknowledges that there is still work to do. He praised Qatar for its role in helping this diplomacy, and U.S. envoy Massad Boulos, the father-in-law of Tiffany Trump.
Our superstar there, Mr. Boulos. What do you want to do next after you're done with this?
Done.
Sudan. Yeah, very important. Actually, very, very important. And you're very involved in that as well. So What are you guys doing this week in Qatar? You guys want to work a little, huh?
U.S. officials see business opportunities out of this deal, and President Trump says the U.S. will be getting some mineral rights in Congo. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Argentine composer Lalo Schifrin, who wrote the theme music for Mission Impossible and the scores for more than 100 other films and TV shows, has died. He was 93 years old. NPR's Bob Mondello offers a remembrance.
This tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Good luck, Jim.
A match flares, a fuse is lit, and another impossible mission is underway, powered by a distinctly Latin beat. Has there ever been a thriller theme more instantly recognizable? For a while in the 1960s and 70s, if a story moved fast, directors wanted it to move to the propulsive rhythms of Lalo Schifrin. He scored episodes for dozens of TV shows and provided theme music for quite a few, including Starsky and Hutch and Mannix. Schifrin grew up in Buenos Aires, surrounded by music. His father played violin in the Teatro Colón opera, so young Lalo's early piano training was classical. But he also played with tango great Astor Piazzolla, represented Argentina in an international jazz festival in Paris, and started a 16-piece jazz band while still in his 20s. An encounter with Dizzy Gillespie resulted in Schifrin writing a piece called Gillespiana. Not long after that, Gillespie brought him to the U.S. as his arranger, and from there, Hollywood beckoned. After scoring all those action scenes in TV shows, Schifrin was hired for the Steve McQueen movie Bullet, oddly to score everything except the big car chase for which the film is famous. Schifrin builds the tension beforehand, and then when McQueen snaps on his seatbelt and guns the engine, the only music you hear for about 7 minutes is the squeal of wheels. But he got to score plenty of other movie chases in pretty much everything that fellow jazz buff Clint Eastwood did for a while, including Dirty Harry. And in a less frenzied vein, he scored Paul Newman's stint in prison in Cool Hand Luke. He also provided the bassline thrum for Roller Coaster's Sense Around, brought tension to the apparitions in the Amityville Horror, frenzy to the killer ants in the documentary Hellstrom Chronicle, and somewhat to his surprise, he was hired to score Bruce Lee's final film, Enter the Dragon, at the star's request. Though Bruce Lee and the composer never met, Lalo Schifrin learned later that the reason he got the gig was that Lee had been running his martial arts practice sessions to the theme from Mission Impossible. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. A growing number of people say antidepressants have left them with debilitating symptoms years, even decades after going off the medications. Increasingly, these people are gathering online and pushing for recognition and research. Emily Corwin with APM Reports has the story.
It was 2013 when Philippa Minari decided to go off her antidepressant Effexor, which she'd started 10 years earlier. Her doctor oversaw the process of quitting, which took a few weeks. And at first, it was fine.
And about 6 to 9 months later, I started feeling horrible. I had nerve pain. My neck and shoulders were sore all the time. My anxiety was through the roof.
All of this was new. Minari says she found it difficult just to stand up. To get disability, a doctor told her to go back on the Effexor, which she later weaned off of more slowly. The nerve pain and exhaustion got better, but she says the debilitating anxiety, it got worse.
It took over 2 years for my brain to calm down enough that I'm not panicking 24/7.
Minari is one of the tens of thousands of people who have turned to online forums while dealing with long-term consequences from antidepressants. Many say their doctors didn't warn them this could happen and didn't believe them when it did. But increasingly, these symptoms are gaining recognition by academic psychiatrists like Nasir Ghami at Tufts University.
I think it's important to understand that severe serotonin withdrawal syndrome does happen with these drugs.
Serotonin withdrawal syndrome. That's what Ghami calls the array of problems that can occur after stopping antidepressants. Researchers have been documenting cases for decades, but virtually no large-scale studies on these conditions exist. Because of that, experts still disagree on what to call them, how to prevent them, and how common they are.
I was just going over this with a colleague recently to potentially try to do a research study on it because we don't know.
Ghami believes long-term effects like Minari's are probably quite rare, but he says severe short-term withdrawal is far more common. What we do know is the longer you take the drugs, the more likely it is you'll have problems going off them. Ghami says treating depression is important.
The solution is not for everyone to never take them, but maybe not to be on them for 10, 15, 20, 30 years.
To be clear, doctors say don't stop antidepressants cold turkey. It's important to go slow. Sven Huba in Western Germany spent 13 years on antidepressants. He says he developed genital numbness one day after he took his first Lexapro pill.
And they also developed extreme emotional numbness.
Huba says the medication did help his mood, but the side effects were too much, so he weaned himself off the drug. He took his last pill a year and a half ago, but the sexual dysfunction and emotional numbness, they haven't gone away.
I can't relate to any family members or friends. Before I took it, I had feelings, bad feelings often, but I felt something, and now I do not feel anything at all.
Huba says his doctor told him this was all in his head. But on the internet, he found forums full of people with similar stories. And these online networks are growing. Take the subreddit for people with Huba's condition, post-SSRI sexual dysfunction, or PSSD. 5 years ago, this Reddit thread had just 1,000 members. Today, 17,000 people subscribe. Nick Alves does outreach for the nonprofit PSSD Network. He says patient advocacy groups like his are starting to get attention, most importantly, from institutions.
We just got like our first ever grants, for example. Like, that's historic in this. That's huge.
These are small research grants funded by the Canadian government. On top of that, Dr. Alan Schatzberg with the influential American Psychiatric Association just told me it has begun looking into the issue. The reason he gave, because a bunch of people who are suffering spoke up. For NPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
And that story came from APM Reports.
Murder numbers are falling dramatically in the U.S. after a surge in 2020 and 2021. City officials often point to policing as a key reason, and that can play an important role. But crime analysts say there's more to it. NPR criminal justice reporter Meg Anderson reports.
When murders decrease, the police are often the first to take note. In Detroit, city officials say homicides are the lowest they've been since 1965. Police Chief Todd Bettison says he's seen a huge difference in officer well-being.
They're not drinking from a fire hose. If you can imagine trying to get a drink of water from a fire hose with all that water coming in.
Detroit is not alone. The number of murders is plummeting nationwide. In 2024, murders fell at least 14% across the country. That's according to the data firm AH Datalytics and other think tanks. Official FBI data only goes through 2023, but shows similar drops. And early data from AH Datalytics suggests the drop could be even bigger in 2025.
We're seeing really not just declines, but large declines and large across-the-board declines. I mean, it's everywhere.
Jeff Asher is co-founder of AH Datalytics. Generally, he says crime goes up and down by only a few percentage points each year.
You think about a really large ship. It doesn't turn fast. These things don't change fast.
And yet they have. Asher and other analysts have zeroed in on an explanation. COVID. All of a sudden, you had a lot of young people who are more likely to commit crimes than older people at home with nothing to do. And a vital support system got ripped away. Public services. Between March and May of 2020, the country's local government workforce shrank by nearly 10%.
They're the biggest employer of teachers. They employ coaches and counselors and aides and all the people that young people connect with.
John Roman is with NORC, a research group at the University of Chicago.
They employ physical health, mental health, behavioral health providers, and they fund all the local programming in the area.
5 years later, local government employment is finally back at pre-pandemic levels. Municipalities are bringing in more money, and their spending has gone up too. That means many services are coming back, and with them, places where young people can find support. In Detroit, Police Chief Bettison credits some of the city's murder decline to changes in policing techniques and higher officer staffing levels, but he also sees it as a citywide team effort.
It's not one thing that drives violence, and so we are always consistently looking for the root causes.
2 years ago, the city invested $10 million in six community organizations. Each group was assigned a section of the city. Their goal was to reduce violence in that area. Negus Vu leads one of those groups. He says their staff focuses on building relationships with young people.
And because of these relationships are genuine and sincere, they're able to refer them to get wraparound services such as substance abuse, job referrals, therapy.
If you meet people's needs, he says, they're less likely to turn to violence. A year after the initiative started, all six groups had seen fewer shootings and homicides in their regions than the citywide average.
We've shown collectively that what we're doing is impactful, effective, and it's saving lives.
But their funding came from the American Rescue Plan Act, the stimulus bill passed in 2021. That money will go away at the end of this summer. The city is funding the program through next summer and pushing the state to enact a public safety trust fund to fully fund the work. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Meg Medina tried for years to write her new novel, but laid it to rest in what she calls her graveyard file. But a book happens in its own time.
This book, I think, taught me the most about being a writer, because we think that we failed. Sometimes it's really just a matter of putting it away for a long while.
Graciela in the Abyss, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump has floated the idea of privatizing air traffic control.
But his transportation secretary doesn't think now is the best time.
To have a fight about privatization is just going to divide people. And what that'll actually do is make sure that we don't actually build a brand new air traffic control system.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Duane Brown. The Supreme Court has handed President Trump a major victory today in his effort to end birthright citizenship. In a 6-3 decision, the justices ruled that federal courts lack authority to grant nationwide injunctions, but the court did not weigh in on the constitutional merits of Trump's executive order to end birthright citizenship. NPR's Carrie Johnson says the high court's decision could apply to numerous other lawsuits.
While the Supreme Court conservative supermajority today did not opine or give an opinion at all about whether the underlying birthright citizenship executive order was lawful, the consequences of their ruling today, basically saying that lower court judges were taking too much power that they didn't have, could apply very significantly in this other slate of cases around the country on Trump's immigration policies, on the executive branch and its power over federal workers, and many other things.
NPR's Carrie Johnson. The Department of Defense says it will stop providing crucial satellite weather data used to forecast hurricanes. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports.
The DOD collects information about conditions in the atmosphere and oceans and shares it with forecasters and scientists. Hurricane forecasters rely on satellite data to figure out where storms are headed and how quickly they'll grow. But the DOD says it will stop sharing the data no later than June 30th. That will cause gaps in hurricane monitoring, which could allow a rapidly strengthening storm to surprise forecasters with its size. A spokesperson for the U.S. Space Force, which operates the satellites, says the satellites are still operating and that the DOD will continue to use the data internally. Space Force referred questions about why the data will no longer be shared to the Navy, which did not respond. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR. A new study finds several brands of disposable e-cigarettes contain high levels of toxic elements, including lead. NPR's Yuki Noguchi tells us they're especially popular among young people.
Disposable versions of e-cigarettes are illegal to sell in the U.S., but the unregulated market continues to flourish. And a group of researchers from UC Davis found that three brands of them in particular, Escobar, Flum Pebble, and Elf Bar, emitted levels of harmful elements like nickel, copper, and lead. The levels far exceeded what's in traditional cigarettes, and well above what could cause cancer, nerve, or respiratory problems. The research, published in the American Chemical Society's journal, noted that market growth has outpaced enforcement or the ability to measure the extent of damage to public health. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Well, President Trump is suspending trade talks with Canada over its tax on American tech firms that goes into effect Monday. This comes after Canada announced it was sticking to its plan to tax Canadian and foreign businesses that engage with online users there. The digital services tax will apply retroactively, hitting companies like Google, Amazon, Meta, Airbnb, and Uber with a 3% tax. Analysts say this will cost U.S. companies $2 billion a year. I'm Duane Brown. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The air traffic control system in the U.S. is in drastic need of an overhaul. The Trump administration wants Congress to approve a multi-billion dollar investment in the Federal Aviation Administration to make changes. But 8 years ago, Trump had a different idea for how to reform air traffic control, privatize it. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports on why that proposal never got off the ground.
For the past few months, U.S. air traffic control has been in the spotlight, especially at Newark's airport in New Jersey, heard here in a recording from liveatc.net.
Austrian 89 heavy exit pop of 4.
High-profile equipment failures and staffing shortages led to waves of flight cancellations and delays in Newark. And in January, a mid-air collision between an American Airlines regional jet and a U.S. Army helicopter near Washington, D.C. killed 67 people and renewed safety concerns about flying. Now the Trump administration wants to modernize the system. In 2017, Trump proposed moving air traffic control out of the government and into a nonprofit, saying the Federal Aviation Administration had failed to improve it.
But after billions and billions of tax dollars spent and the many years of delays, we're still stuck with an ancient, broken, antiquated, horrible system that doesn't work.
Trump wasn't the first president to float the idea. The Clinton administration proposed making air traffic control a quasi-government corporation in 1994, but neither plan took off. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said recently he doesn't think now is the time for privatization.
To have a fight about privatization is just going to divide people. And what that'll actually do is make sure that we don't actually build a brand new air traffic control system.
Still, some advocates say privatization ought to be given another chance in light of the recent problems with the aviation sector. Robert Poole, director of transportation policy at the libertarian think tank Reason Foundation, says air traffic control should be turned into a public utility like electricity or water.
The basic case for air traffic control is that it has many of these characteristics of a utility. It could be run by a government corporation, by a nonprofit corporation, or a regulated private corporation.
Canada privatized its air traffic control system in 1996, and other countries, including the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand, removed their systems from direct government control. Poole says that makes it easier to raise and spend money, and it gives the government more independence to act as a safety regulator.
Today, when it comes to air traffic control, FAA basically regulates itself.
Opponents say privatization hasn't always worked well for the countries that have done it. They point to staffing issues and safety problems. And according to Jim Kuhn with the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, it could also hurt smaller airports and pilots that don't produce the same economic impact as large airlines.
That would be very detrimental to many small communities around the country that rely on these small airports for medical issues, for disaster relief, for businesses.
Even the major airlines, once supporters of privatization, have cooled on it. Kuhn says the aviation industry is instead lining up behind the Trump administration's plan to modernize air traffic control and is largely leaving privatization behind.
It's been discussed for decades. There's not consensus there. But there is consensus now to modernize our system, and that's what we want to do.
Secretary Duffy says with the right amount of funding from Congress, that process could take just 4 years. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
With sophisticated American air defenses in increasingly short supply, Ukraine's been relying on its own methods to protect its skies from the Russian drones. NPR's Joanna Kakissis traveled to the Black Sea to watch one air defense team in action. And a warning, this report contains the sound of gunfire.
It's early morning when we board a small Navy speedboat near the port of Odessa. Its crew, Artem, Ilya, and Pirat, are inside. At the request of Ukraine's military, which cites security reasons, NPR is only using the soldier's first name or call sign. Artem is tall and bearded. He used to work as a car mechanic before the war. He climbs into a seat behind a large mounted machine gun. He tells us to hang on as the speedboat departs. It's going to get wet now, he says, and squints in the salty wind. We're picking up speed now and we're heading into the open sea, into the Black Sea. For months after Russia's full-scale invasion, Russian warships blocked access to the Black Sea. Then Ukraine used sea drones to push out Russia's fleet. Now the Ukrainian Navy has speedboats on the Black Sea 24/7, searching the skies for attack drones. So we spot the drones every time they head in our direction, Artem says. Sometimes we see them every day for a week. Sometimes there is a lull. Russia says the drones only aim for military installations. Artem doesn't buy it. I do not see the Russians targeting military objects, he says. They are simply terrorizing the civilian population. Ukraine's military also tries to protect Odessa on the ground by using anti-aircraft missiles and snipers on trucks. Odessa is vulnerable because it's on the Black Sea coast, says Ilya, the speedboat unit's commander. We work more than the air defense teams on land, he says. Ilya's wiry and baby-faced, leaning against the speedboat's guardrail. He joined the military a decade ago when he was 17. When attack drones are on their way to Odessa, he says it's really up to us to intercept them. The crew shares a video with NPR that shows them aiming for drones. In this clip, the crew is using the mounted machine gun to shoot down an Iranian-designed Shahed drone, which looks like a small plane and sounds like a giant lawnmower. A monitor shows a black triangle in the sky falling, trailed by black smoke. Ilya says the crew can only intercept about 30% of drones. The Russians launch them in such large groups, he says, we cannot destroy them all. Steering the speedboat is Pirat. A photo of his wife and baby son are on the dashboard. He says he thinks of them whenever his crew shatters an enemy drone. We celebrate because that drone will not fly into someone's neighborhood, he says. His own neighborhood recently had a close call. That really got to me, Pirat says, because the drone hit a building close to my family. Destroying a drone can sometimes put the crew at risk. Pirat recalls one incident earlier this month. The drone did not explode, he says, and it was nosediving toward us. We maneuvered around it, and it fell very close to the stern. Pirat pauses and stares ahead. Maybe, he says, the war will end someday, and the Black Sea will again be filled with sailing yachts. Russian drones often strike at night, and on this morning, the sky is clear. Pirat touches the photo of his wife and baby, then steers the speedboat toward the horizon. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, reporting from the Black Sea.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A mostly abandoned airfield in the Florida Everglades is getting a new life as a migrant detention center. Officials are calling it Alligator Alcatraz. That's a nod to the infamous island prison off the San Francisco coast. Environmentalists and other activists are trying to stop it. NPR's Rachel Treisman has been covering the story and joins us now. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
Okay, so where did this whole idea even come from?
So this idea came about last week. Florida's Attorney General James Uthmeyer announced it in a video on social media. It's basically part of the state's efforts to support the Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration. Mm-hmm. It has set a goal of arresting 3,000 migrants a day. And Uthmeyer's saying some of them should be held at the Dade Collier Training and Transition Airport. And this is why.
You don't need to invest that much in the perimeter. The People get out, there's not much waiting for them other than alligators and pythons.
Wow, that rock music.
Right. So the federal government approved the plan earlier this week, and as far as we know, construction is underway right now.
What do we know exactly about this facility?
This is an airstrip in the Big Cypress National Preserve, which borders Everglades National Park. That's over 1 million acres of wildlife and fragile wetlands. This airport is not very often used. It has just one runway, and that's about 11,000 feet long. It's mostly been used for training until now. Uffmeyer now says the facility will be temporary and mostly made up of tents and trailers, so not much construction needed. That means, according to Uffmeyer, it's on track to open in early July with about 5,000 beds and then ramp up from there.
That's right around the corner. Okay, so then who exactly is paying for this?
Taxpayers, basically. The Department of Homeland Security told us it will cost Florida some $450 million to run this facility for a year. It also says the state can submit reimbursement requests to FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
So what's been the broader reaction to this proposal?
There's been a lot of criticism from different groups. For one, there's immigration advocates. They're worried about a lack of oversight and, of course, the living conditions, especially in the Florida humidity and during hurricane season this summer. Yeah. There's also indigenous communities. They consider the area to be their sacred ancestral homeland. Miami-Dade County owns the land, and even its mayor has voiced concerns about the environmental impacts. But the state is moving ahead. It's using emergency powers to seize the land and develop it. Environmental groups dedicated to protecting the Everglades are trying to stop the project, including by filing lawsuits. And actually, these kinds of protests have worked before.
Oh, they have? When was that?
In the late 1960s. This exact airfield actually was supposed to be the site of the Everglades Jetport, which was envisioned as the largest airport in the world. But citizens were really worried about the environmental impact, and a coalition of Floridians came together in protest, and they were able to pressure the government to drop the project. They stopped work in 1970. It doesn't seem like that is as likely to happen this time around. Florida's governor, Ron DeSantis, has downplayed those concerns. He said this week there will be, quote, zero environmental impacts.
That is NPR's Rachel Treisman. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Steve Aoki is more than a genre-defining musician with years of EDM hits. This is a man whose touring gear is in the Smithsonian. He's in the Guinness Book of World Records as most traveled musician in 1 year. And alongside his fashion line, memoir, charitable foundation, and more, Steve Aoki is still churning out enormous hits, working with some of the biggest artists around. His latest album is called Hero Quest 3 Paragon. I thought it was gonna be just a two-beer Tuesday night. Just about every song on this album is a collaboration, and with artists from a huge variety of genres. Nile Rodgers, the Brazilian singer Ludmilla. One of the main singles is this pop country song with Tyler Hubbard. And I say we won't forget tonight the way you laugh when I spill my whiskey. I can't believe I asked you, say shove and kiss me. I asked Steve Aoki how he corrals such a wide array of genres into a quote-unquote EDM sound.
In the beginning, it was a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was in L.A. People come to L.A. and get in the studio and you can work. But since then, since I left L.A. and had been touring about 200 plus shows a year, I take that as a way to be able to experience and explore different genres and meet different artists from different genres. Sometimes it doesn't go anywhere. Sometimes it ends up becoming something really unique that sits between EDM and that other genre.
Yeah. Was there one style of music that you thought to yourself, I don't know if this is going to work with what I do, but let's give it a try, and you were pleased with how it turned out?
I mean, I remember even 15 years ago when I started working with hip-hop artists, I was getting a lot of hate, a lot of people that just were not down with
that. Stay in your own lane kind of hate?
Yeah, just anytime you do something outside of the space that you're supposed to be in, you're going to get some criticism. But I mean, that worked, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, the hybridization between hip hop and EDM feels so completely integrated that it's not even a question.
Yeah, it's at the end of the day, electronic music, EDM, it's like the instrumental of a vocalist. Tell me what you know about dreams, dreams. Tell me what you know about night. There is nothing. You don't really care about the trials of tomorrow. Rather lay awake in the bed full of sorrow.
You have now been in the EDM scene for so many years through the kind of rise and fall of dance music, and it feels like right now we're in a boom time. There are more electronic acts at music festivals, fewer rock acts. Digital platforms like Boiler Room are huge. How do you see the state of electronic music right now?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, I've seen the wave from the early 2000s to now, and it's absolutely peaking. From a cultural standpoint, when you see the multi-genre festivals, like you're talking about, where it's the artists that are viral or the artists that are being talked about more at the Coachellas are the EDM acts.
And the pace moves so much more quickly now when social media allows somebody to trend on TikTok and you've never heard of them before. And then the next day it's someone else after that.
It's true.
How has that changed the landscape, not just for new artists, but for you working to remain relevant after all this time?
You have to think differently about how you release a song.
I mean,
you're
still
releasing
a 20-track album, which nobody does anymore, especially not in EDM.
Yeah, so I definitely have always thought differently in this space. I am one of the few people in the EDM space that care about dropping albums. A lot of my friends, they're like, we don't ever have to drop an album. We just have to drop a single. Mm-hmm. And you're like, shouldn't I do that? Should I just focus on one song versus a project? And I veered towards the project. It would hurt my soul to just have to hold back these other ideas, even if they're smaller.
From this latest batch of 20-some new tracks, is there one that you're like, I know this is not going to be the one that's constantly getting radio play, but I love it and I need it to be in the world?
Thanks to You, I think, is a song I really hope has a huge impact for my world, at least for the EDM world.
This is featuring Bomb.
Yeah, it just has a really great vocal resonance. The lyrics are meaningful. That's kind of like going to be an underdog for the album, for sure.
You're constantly on the road playing shows, along with so many other projects that you juggle. And I have a sense of what your fans are chasing when they buy a ticket to a Steve Aoki show. What are you chasing by keeping up the pace that you do?
Well, I love it. You know, that's like first and foremost, I love playing shows. And the fact that I get to play to different crowds from all different parts of the world, going to these different countries and meeting different producers and different cultures and sounds, it expands my music. I have to say the fans make the biggest impact to me if I'm gonna work with artists in that region.
That's interesting, because when I see you perform, the fans look like a mass of thousands of people. The idea that you connect with individuals when you're in and out of those countries in a day is something I wouldn't have expected.
It's also the after effect. You know, you see it on social media. You know, like whenever I play in Romania, the crowd's crazy everywhere. But then when I leave, I just keep seeing Romanian fans, like just making sure they're heard and seen. Then I want to work with Romanian artists. I'm like,
Have you collaborated with a Romanian artist?
I did. I was being driven to the show, and I asked the driver, I'm like, I want to work with some Romanian artists, but I need some fresh takes on it. So I was like, can you play me some records out here that are big? So he played me this song, Do Da Do. And I immediately DM'd the artist while I was listening to the song. I'm like, this song is so good. And I DM'd her.
Irina Rimes, right?
Irina Rimes, yeah. And she sent me the stems, and I got it done in like 7 days. I played it at the festival and people went crazy because I'm remixing a Romanian song, you know, and then it just makes me feel like just happy that I'm able to be of service to a world of people that show me so much love.
Well, Steve Aoki, thank you so much for talking with us about your career and your music.
Thank you.
His new album is called Hero Quest 3 Paragon. I lost my friends, I don't know.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Early in the morning when it's dark.